And on the other hand, I wanted to show my loyalty, man. I wanted to show my loyalty to my homies. This was my moment to show my homies all my appreciation for having my back, man, for so many years and practically raising me as far as the streets was concerned. I felt like, man, I felt like I didn't have a choice. I needed to hop in the ride and represent. One night and one ride, I knew it. I knew it could change the rest of my life for the rest of my life. But I guess that's why I was so grateful when Lil B came and he called my name that night. He said, E. Man, E, I thought it meant we all made it back to the block alive without anyone getting hurt or, more importantly, getting put in the bag. Plus, we made it off the premise before the police made it to the game. Yo, E, you still headed down south for college with Didi, right? Right? In the fall? Lil B said like a concerned parent. No doubt, I said, without being cocky, but with this proud feeling. Lil B's next words, man, they shocked me because I assume he wanted to talk about how I beat my man down that night. Then you need to get out of here. You're not like the rest of us, man. E, you got a chance, man. You got an opportunity of a lifetime. Don't mess it up. Get out of here, E. Get out of here, man, while you are alive. I'm proud of you, boy. Yeah, and not for the fight. No, I'm proud of you, boy, because you're getting to go to college. So do me a favor. Get out of here, man. Go and make the twain proud of you forever. I turned to Lil B and said, I promise. I promise, B. I promise I'm going to make you proud. And I also promise that college won't change me, homie. And I walked away from the twain that day, and I never looked back. Got my GED. At some point in life, you have to face your fears. And I mean head on, even though you can't be sure of the outcomes. A great deal of people will never reach their dreams. And it won't have anything to do with their abilities or skill set. They won't reach their dreams because they were too afraid to try. As I took my seat, my palms were sweaty, and I could feel my legs shaking uncontrollably. E, relax, calm down, take your time. Everything is gonna be fine, I said to myself. But as soon as I closed my eyes to pray, thoughts of failure raced through my head. It was hard to ignore the negative voices screaming in my head. There's no way you're going to pass this test. You have never been good at test taking. You're too dumb for college. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't shake the voices. Instead of panicking, I stopped and whispered up a silent prayer. I remember my past experiences that whenever I was in a crisis, if I could just close my eyes, bam, and pray, that would change things. Okay, I can do this. I can do this. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they protect me. And no sooner as the words were leaving my mouth, I could feel it. I could feel the presence of calm come over me. And I felt at ease. It was as if God himself came down in the classroom and said, in a still, small voice, relax, son. Take your time. Everything is going to be fine. I was young, but I was wise enough to know that if God said it, that settled it. So I paused. I grabbed my pencil. I filled out my name on the Scantron, and I went to work. I approached the GED test in a way I had never approached a test. This exam had major lifelong implications. It was much deeper than an alphabetical scale like A, B, C, D, or an F. No, this exam was for all the marbles. And if I fail, I knew I would be broken. My entire future was riding on the results from this exam. For one, I could potentially lose my girlfriend. I'm talking about lose her for life. And two, I would be trapped in Detroit for the rest of my life. I learned quickly that the hood, it's a dead end. I didn't know one drug dealer that retired from the game. And even if the feds didn't catch up with them, some jealous snitch either ratted on them or some scorned female set them up. And worse than that, I didn't want to be one of those cats sitting on the porch drinking a 40-ounce, reminiscing. You know, reminiscing about what I could have been, what I should have done. On the other hand, if I passed that test, it was an automatic renewal on my life. A renewal I so desperately needed. The one negative thing about the test was it was timed, so I had to be strategic. I didn't want to rush it and risk making mistakes, but I couldn't afford to be so methodical and waste so much time focusing on one section. So my strategy was to skip all the questions I didn't know immediately and focus my energy on the questions I knew, or let me say the ones I thought I knew. The majority of the sections lasted about, I'd say, an hour and a half, and that gave me enough time to nail the ones I knew and wrestle with the questions that were written in, I guess you can say, a seemingly foreign language. And during my breaks, I was so nervous, I ain't talked to nobody. I didn't even use the payphone to call Didi. I spent the entire break just praying. I felt really good about my chances to pass the exam. Well, that was until the instructor handed out the written portion. That's when my heart dropped. In my mind, the other sections of the test, they were easy because they only required deductive reasoning. I mean, I read a passage, and based on the information, I selected, I'd say, one of four possible answers. The written portion, though, that was just the opposite. It was like a blank sheet of paper with nothing on it. And to make matters even worse, they allotted the least amount of time to complete that section. I wasted the first 15 minutes just trying to create a thesis. Like, I began writing for what seemed like only about 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden I heard, "Please place your pencils down and pass your exam to the front of the room." I was like, unbelievable. Those words, they pierced through my chest, and I felt like I was having a massive heart attack. I closed my eyes and shook my head. I barely finished the conclusion, and I didn't even have enough time to go back and edit my work. I vividly remember thinking, I got that close to having a fresh start. Your results will be ready tomorrow afternoon. All you need to do is visit the administrative office tomorrow after 3 p.m. with a valid ID, and your results will be provided. However, your written portion will be mailed to D.C. for further review, and the results should be available within 2 or 3 weeks. 2 or 3 weeks, I shouted loudly. "Yes, 2 or 3 weeks, Mr. Thomas," the instructor responded. The next day I woke up with a serious knot in my stomach, and I was quiet the entire day. I didn't have much of an appetite, and I didn't really feel like being real social. The test results were the only thing on my mind. I got dressed, out of the house, and at the bus stop a whole hour early. I made it to the school about 2:30 p.m. and was the first person. Yep, for the first time, I was the first person in that office. I walked up to the window. I wrote down my name, time of arrival, and pulled out my ID. About 27 minutes later, the receptionist called my name and handed me a manila envelope with my name on the top left corner. and said, "Good luck, Mr. Thomas." I'm generally cordial, but I was so nervous, I just grabbed the envelope and walked out. I went outside to open the envelope so no one in the room would see my reaction to those scores. I must have walked at least a mile up the street before I opened the envelope, thinking to myself, my life is contained in this small envelope. Isn't that crazy? I finally opened it and browsed through the scores. Initially, the numbers didn't really make a whole lot of sense, but at the bottom of the GED document, there was a section that said you needed at least a 410 in each section, and like I think an average of 450, which would equate to about 2,110 points or something like that. I took a deep breath, looked down at my scores, and did the mental math. I wasn't surprised that I didn't score 450 in every section, but when I added it all up, when I added up all the sections, I realized I passed. And not only did I passed with flying colors. But unfortunately, I had mixed emotions. Like, I wanted to run to the nearest payphone and call Dee Dee and tell her, I passed. But the last thing I wanted to do was call her and celebrate prematurely, only to find out later that I had failed the writing portion. In fact, I was more terrified afterwards, realizing I passed the first phase, than I was taking the test in the first place. I remember thinking, I had more to lose now than I've ever had to lose in my entire life. See, if I had never taken the test in the first place, I could always say I would have passed it if I had taken it. I just didn't feel like taking it. That's all. That way, I would have never had to face my fears. I could have created like this illusion, in my mind to prevent me from feeling like a failure. I was good with that. But the stakes were so high and there was no turning back at this point. If I failed a written portion, man, Eric is a complete failure. That's what would have been written in stone forever. And my fate would have been sealed. So when I spoke with Dee Dee later that day, man, I just told her I got to wait 2 more weeks to get my results. It seemed like the longest 2 or 3 weeks of my life. But one random weekday, I got a letter from the Department of Education. I remember sitting there, looking at it for a while before I even opened it. It was pouring down raining outside, and the wind was whipping against the window in a fierce manner. My eyes began to water, and my neck began its infamous twitch. I opened the letter, and I read it slowly. "Dear Mr. Thomas, the nature of this letter is to inform you that you have successfully completed the written portion of the GED. Congratulations." I dropped the letter and took off running down the street. In the middle of the street, while it was raining, yelling and screaming uncontrollably, "Woo! Woo!" I ran back inside, grabbed the letter, stuck it in my pocket so it wouldn't get wet, and jumped on Dee Dee's Honda Spree motorcycle and headed to her to tell her the good news. Riding through the rain with the biggest grin on my face, the only thoughts on my mind were, "Look out, world. Here comes your boy, E.T. It's so hard to say goodbye. Going to the next level is not as easy as one may think. People think the only requirement is giving up all the bad habits. That's the easy part. The difficult part about pursuing your dreams is that it often requires us to sacrifice some of the things that we cherish. For instance, you may have to sever several relationships, certain things, and certain places. It was the latter that made it hard for me to say goodbye. Despite all the negativity and all the things I had been through, Detroit still had a special place in my heart. Hell, all I really ever knew was Detroit. So even though I was excited about the idea of going away to college, I was afraid. Yeah, I was afraid because it was so far away from home. They said Alabama was approximately like 700 miles away from Detroit. That's a long way from the only place I really ever knew as home. And although my mom and I had an estranged relationship, and things, yeah, they were far from what they used to be, I still thought about her and my sister a lot. And I couldn't imagine being so far away from them. I didn't have any family in Huntsville, Alabama, or friends for that matter. I knew Alabama would not be like Detroit. In fact, all I heard about was racism. You know, the KKK and how African Americans were treated like second-class citizens down south. But I was willing. Yep, I was willing to take that chance and venture out into the unknown if it meant being with Dee Dee for the rest of my life. I'll never forget the day we packed Dee's mother's excursion van. After packing my bags, I had a prayer with the cannoneers. Sister Cannoneer gave me a great big hug and a bag with lunch for the road. Brother Cannoneer gave me a hug and said in his West Indies accent, "I'm proud of you, son, but don't come back without your degree." Then I made my final visits. I drove by St. Bede on 12 Mile and then past Southfield Lathrop on my way to my parents. As I approached the house, the events that occurred over 2 years ago started to replay in my head. And as I walked through the doors, I gave my little sister Janico and Mallory a hug and a kiss and told them I loved them and that I would miss them. I spoke with my parents briefly. They gave me a brief pep talk and $1,000 in cash and wished me well. And before I went to Dee Dee's house, there was one more stop I knew I had to make, a stop that I had been dreading since the day I found out I passed that GED test. That stop was to my boy Bob's house. As I got out of the car, I began feeling sick to the stomach. Bob, man, Bob meant the world to me. And now I felt as if I was leaving him high and dry. So as I approached the house and started walking up the stairs, I began imagining that he was coming with me and that I was just there to pick him up. And so I knocked on the door and Bob came out with that classic smile on his face. "You out of here, boy?" he asked in an excited tone. "Yeah, bruh, I'm out." Bob could see the anguish in my face and tried to lighten the mood. "E, come on, E. You know I'm gonna come down there and visit you at least once or twice a month, right? Oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm getting a car soon, so I'll be down there, man, and it's gonna be like old times. Don't even trip." I remember feeling so guilty. I mean, here was the guy that poured so much into me at a time when I had absolutely nothing or nobody. And man, I'm the one going off to college while Bob is staying here in Detroit. Bob was the first one who even told me about Oakwood years ago, like years before I even thought about going to college. Man, I would have traded spots with Bob that instant if I thought I could. You getting a car? I mean, the moment was so awkward, that's all I could manage to say. "It's all good, E, man. Look, you better get going, bruh. I know how Dee Dee is, look. And if you late, she gonna be all on your head. Thanks, man. Thanks." "Man, you ain't gotta thank." "No, B, for real. For real, man. Thanks, man. I mean, man, thanks for everything you done for me. Like, if it wasn't for you, I would never be going to college. For real, man. Thanks. Realizing I was serious, Bob reached out and we executed that patent handshake we made up years ago. And then we followed it up with, you know, like a brief hug. E, promise me, man. Promise me you'll call me as soon as you get down there. Bob yelled out as I opened up the car door. No doubt, bruh. No doubt, I promise. I shut the car door, and as I headed to Dee Dee's house, man, I tried so hard not to cry. But unsuccessfully, I couldn't hold back the tears anymore as they ran out of the corner of my eyes. On my way to Dee Dee's house, I drove past Henry Ford and up Trojan to Braille, reminiscing the entire time. And when I finally made it there, her mom had packed all Dee Dee's stuff. So I put my bike and my suitcase in the van and sat quietly in the back of the van as we headed to Alabama. We hit 75 towards Toledo and we passed Tiger Stadium. Man, it's so hard to say goodbye to Detroit.
Chapter 10, Oakwood, It's a Different World. Surround yourself with positive people and look for people who are already where you want to be.
I will be the first to admit that I did not go to college with the best game plan in mind. For one, I could not decide what I wanted to major in. And two, I'll be honest, I wasn't really sure what courses I should take, or let me put it like this, what I shouldn't take. I was like a deer in headlights. But despite my academic indecisiveness, one thing was for sure. I knew I had come too far to fail, and I promised myself. That's right, I promised myself that this time I would choose my inner circle more wisely. I knew. Not from what somebody told me. I knew from firsthand experience, not from what I read in a book or what my parents said, how one friendship could make or break me as a person. And so I spent the first few weeks just observing. I knew I wasn't the smartest apple in the bunch, but my ability to judge a person's character was, real reliable. And for those who have spent any real time in the hood, I knew that they had acquired the skill to survive. And so like a hawk that hovers over a particular area, waiting for the right moment to scoop in, I observed everybody on campus, everybody I came in contact with. I watched and I listened to their conversations. And to the best of my ability, I tried to determine who was just talking and who was serious. And I knew if I was going to make it in this new environment, I would have to surround myself with individuals who knew, that's right, who knew where they were headed and had a serious plan of action. For example, I could not hook up with people just because they were from Chicago or Detroit, or because football was their favorite sport or because they were Virgos. If I was going to survive and get the most out of my college experience, I needed to be strategic. And I needed to select people in my inner circle, man, just like I would, if I was drafting for a professional sport team or selecting like the number one player in the draft. And with his first pick in the 1989 Inner Circle Draft, Eric Thomas selects Irvin Daphnis. What drew me to Daphnis? Like all the greats, he had this aura about himself. He stood about 6 feet tall. He was dark, with a thin bill, and glided across campus with this silent confidence that screamed, "Look out, world, because here comes Daphnis." Irvin was the only person I knew who was so confident in himself and so proud of himself that this guy walked around with dashikis and he sported dashikis like they were Jordans. I can still picture him walking through campus, even today, with this one colorful dashiki with the continent of Africa embroidered right about his chest. And besides his iridescent swag, Irvin was extremely intelligent. But it wasn't necessarily his intelligence that drew me to him. It was his crossover ability that intrigued me. Even though Irvin had the ability to go toe-to-toe with the best of them, and although as a freshman, he easily matched the intelligence of most upperclassmen, he never felt the need to isolate himself from the average Joe like myself. He also had a passion for knowledge, and he identified with the struggles of his people. In the words of James Brown, Irvin was black and proud, and he did not mind saying it out loud. In fact, Irvin was so proud of his heritage that we nicknamed him Black. I remember the first oratorical contest I attended and watched Irv go to work. He breezed through the first few rounds and made it to the finals. I have to be honest, I was nervous when I found out he was competing against this other freshman by the name of Furman Fordham, also known as Pucky. I was blown away the first time I heard him speak as well. His gift was his command of words. He was like a walking dictionary. He ran in different circles, though, but I admire him from afar. He was one of those guys who made me feel like, man, I didn't stand a chance at the collegiate level. He reminded me of one of those most likely to succeed guys, and every time I heard him address the crowd, I kept thinking to myself, if those are the type of skills you need to succeed in college, well, I don't stand a chance. But to my surprise, the contest was a dogfight. They were going back and forth and back and forth. Pucky was doing his usual verbal acrobatics, while Irv orchestrated a well-balanced speech arrayed with verbal, theatrical, and contemplative skills. It was a tough decision for the judges. But to my surprise, Irvin pulled off the upset. I walked away from that contest a changed man. Watching another black male freely articulate in the way Irv did that day gave me a confidence that I needed to start believing in myself and my abilities. Not to mention the fact I discovered that Irvin was Haitian, and the fact that he was a first-generation American inspired me even further. I knew if Irvin's people could come to this country and succeed and help him overcome his obstacles to become the person he was, there was absolutely no more excuses for me. Irvin had the blueprint, the competitive advantage, and all I needed to do was sit under his feet so I could learn from him. Bell Tower Ministry. Start where you are with what you have, for what you have is plenty. Science was not my favorite subject in school, and I think it had a lot to do with the fact that science was so complex. I remember thinking, there are quite a few theories to memorize, and after about, I say, 20 or more, I kind of figured this might not be the subject I want to spend the rest of my life studying. But I must admit, I somewhat liked the whole symbiosis lesson, you know, because I could use it to gauge any relationship. It was simple and straight to the point. All relationships, whether the relationship was between me and my homeboys or with a female, all of them fell into three categories. Mutualism, both individuals in the relationship were benefiting from the relationship. Commensalism, only one person in the relationship was benefiting and the other person was not getting anything out of the deal. Or parasiticism, somebody in a relationship is benefiting greatly while the other person is getting played. When I got to college, I used the concept from symbiosis to decide which relationships to invest in and which ones to cut. My relationship with Irv, a.k.a. Black, that one was a no-brainer. I knew I was not on his level. He clearly had more to offer in the relationship than I did. For one, he finished high school and was clearly more intelligent than I was. For two, he had some leadership experience because he served as a youth leader for the Urban League in his community in Miami. And to top it off, that boy, he had impeccable administrative skills. My only challenge was to make sure that I did not fall into either the category of commensalism or parasitism. I knew it was not about equal giving. It was about equal sacrifice. I had a slight advantage, though, because I knew what most people did not know. Even the greats, that's right, even the greats needed a competent sidekick. From time to time, Batman needed Robin. The Long Ranger needed Tonto. Laverne needed Shirley. And even MJ needed Scottie Pippen. So between the codes of ethics I learned in the hood and what I knew about mutualism, I knew this relationship could create a dynamic duo.
Stay in your lane. Don't try to do more than you're capable of doing.
I could not have written a script any better. 3 months into the school year, Black and Trey, Melvin Hayden III, called me in on an executive meeting. To this day, I'm not sure how Trey became a part of this team, but just know this, Trey elevated Black and me from a dynamic duo to a tenacious trio. They wanted me to know that they felt God was leading them to do something major on campus, but they did not know exactly what it was. So Trey initiated a fast. He believed that fasting was a way of clearing the mind from all distractions so we could get in tune with the mind of God. So the plan was to fast from everything but water for 7 days. I don't think I've ever mentioned it to anybody, but I was scared to death. I did not grow up in the church, so fasting was a foreign concept. It wasn't that I did not understand the premise behind fasting. My problem was I couldn't understand why someone would deliberately want to go without eating for 7 days. Why would anybody voluntarily inflict that type of pain on himself or herself? It didn't make sense to me, especially since I had already been homeless and starving on the streets of Detroit just a year prior. But despite how ludicrous the idea sounded at first, I consented. I gave in. All I can say is that 3 months after the fast, we became a part of a groundbreaking, life-changing program that not only took the campus by storm, but would also eventually transform our lives and impact the entire world. It was amazing to see what was birthed from a small meeting of three and a 7-day fast. The student-led initiative would be known as the Bell Tower Ministry. The concept itself wasn't new. We just took a familiar idea and added a few components, you know, to enhance it. Now, Black was the president and founder. Trey, he was the vice president and our spiritual advisor. And I was the glue guy. You know, the one who had to keep us all together. And by the grace of God, I was never jealous of the relationship between Black and Trey. I never once thought I should be the president. You know, because I knew Black first. Besides, I always knew Trey was a better number two man than I was, and that I could best serve the squad from a supporting role. Honestly speaking, Trey's presence took us to a whole nother level. He was so different from Black in that he added a spiritual and meek dimension that was missing. Trey was way more level-headed and methodical than Black and I, who tended to be a bit more radical and, you know, outspoken. And even though my contributions were less noticeable, they were still critical to our ministry's growth. I brought that Detroit, blue collar mentality to the squad. I helped design programs on and off campus that helped individuals regain their hope academically and spiritually. My messages were real, relevant, and delivered in a plain, you know, English style. But one of the things I made sure not to do was to try to duplicate what Black and Trey were already doing. As long as I stayed in my lane and did not try to be a big shot, I was safe. So I passed out flyers, went from dorm room to dorm room making announcements, and I also opened and closed the events with a short speech. Whatever grunt work Black or Trey asked me to do, I did it with honor. As I matured, Black and Trey gradually began to give me more responsibilities and opportunities. It was a perfect demonstration of teamwork and everyone playing their position.
I much prefer the sharpest criticism of a single intelligent man to the thoughtless approval of the masses. Johann Kepler.
In addition to our weekly planning meetings, we also met weekly for what was known as a lemon squeeze. Every Friday afternoon, the executive team was required to participate in a weekly constructive criticism session. The purpose of the session was to help the members of the Bell Tower Ministries identify and eliminate personal weaknesses and build on their strengths. Black always preached, "We are only as strong as our weakest link." He believed that all the great empires fell from within. I remember going to every single meeting tense, like with knots in my stomach. You never knew, I mean never knew, what another member was going to say about you or someone else. The lemon squeeze session, in my opinion, they were always dangerous. Personally, I had never been in a setting with my peers where we spoke so freely and honestly about other people's faults. Where I come from, if a person talked to somebody like that, it was bound to turn into a knockdown, drag-out fight. The only time anyone remotely addressed a brother's weakness and it not turn into a fight was doing like a roasting session, you know, playing the dozens. Even then, if a person was not careful, it could go from a roast to a heavyweight prize fight. The rules were simple. The group would select one individual from the team to take 5 to 10 minutes to share with a certain individual their opinion about what that person needed to work on, you know, over the next week or two. The team member who was critiqued was not allowed, and I mean absolutely was not allowed to respond. And after each member gave his remarks, the individual was then asked to explain how he could use the constructive criticism to elevate his personal and organizational game. The sessions always ended with praise. Black believed the sessions should always end with the message that each individual was valued, not only as a person, but also their contributions to the organization were valued. Hence the name, the lemon squeeze. Our meetings started with constructive criticism and then adding the sugar to make lemonade. I'm not sure which was more salient, the actual process or the things I learned about myself during each session. The process taught me the value of being proactive. Black realized he did not want, and I mean he did not want to wait for personality differences or petty misunderstandings to erode our mission. He knew he could cut it off before it gained any momentum. More importantly, I learned through the process that by decreasing your threats, you simultaneously increase your growth and success.
Chapter 11. Should have put a ring on it. One half of me is yours, the other half yours, mine own. I would say, but if mine, then yours, and so all yours. William Shakespeare.
After my freshman year, I could truly say that college was everything I heard it would be, and even more of what I dreamt it to be. In fact, when you look at my grades, they were an indicator of just how much fun I had during my freshman year. Look, I traveled more than I had ever traveled in my entire life, and most of all of my travels were outside of the Midwest. I went as far as I could go and make it back to class by Monday morning. We went to Nashville, Louisville, Knoxville, like all the Villes, Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, and as far south as Miami. I took full advantage, and I do mean full advantage, of the campus life. I went to every basketball game, played in every spades tournament, played in every intramural sports event available, never said no to a bowling tournament, and missed as many days on the job as I could and still keep my work study. But nothing, and I do mean nothing, made my freshman experience as memorable as the time I spent with my girl D. Look, man, it was so special because we didn't have to worry about her mother, right? I could see her every single day. As a matter of fact, we even had class together. Our love for each other grew on campus in ways I don't think it could have ever grown in Detroit. For instance, at least the first two quarters of school, we would go to church together, some co-ed worship services together, and in between classes, we would walk through the campus and have worship together. The one thing I didn't have to worry about, I never ever had to worry about getting Dee Dee pregnant, you know, and having to leave college and go back home because of all the strict rules. You know, in actuality, those strict rules helped us to take our relationship to a whole nother level. I mean, Dee Dee and I were able to slow down, you know, take our relationship real slow and focus on getting to know one another. Huntsville, it wasn't a big city like Detroit, so we had a chance to spend the majority of our time just walking, talking, studying, you know, and getting to know each other on a deeper level. I don't want to grow up, because even if I did, I wouldn't be a Toys R Us kid. Yeah, I can't really explain, how I knew, but after my freshman year, I knew it. I knew I couldn't let Dee Dee get out of my sight. I mean, I knew I couldn't let her go. And so after my freshman year, that summer, I decided to ask Dee Dee to be my wife. So after my freshman year, we got married. And once we got married, man, you couldn't tell me nothing. I used to joke with my boys and say, take out your cameras and get a snapshot of this. Because this, my friend, this is what a grown-ass man looks like. But it didn't take long for reality to set in. And the kid, my bubble was bursting. Once the honeymoon stage ended, it was back to life, back to reality. I soon discovered dreaming is one thing, but at some point, you got to get up, get out, and get something. Somehow, I had been led astray about marriage. I thought all I had to do was dream about it. You know, just dream about how I wanted my marriage to look like, you know, be like. And from time to time, share the dream with my wife, probably over like a candlelight dinner or something. But like I said, man, reality set in. Then I remember, I married a Detroit sister. And from my experience, sisters from Detroit, they were cut from a totally different cloth, and it did not take long before my wife started in on me. You call yourself a man? What kind of man plays video games all day? When are you going to fill out a job application, you know, and get a real job? She thought as soon as we got married, I was going to make a swift transition from a boy to a man, but it didn't happen. Somehow, I came back to school still very immature. Instead of looking for a job, I was over my boy Bob's house playing Tecmo Bowl. And if I wasn't playing video games, I was on campus in a planning session for the Bell Tower Ministries. What I wasn't doing was handling my business. You know, handling my responsibilities as a new husband. Until one evening, or should I say, one early morning, I came home about 2 a.m. from the Bell Tower Ministries. The bell generally ended right at curfew, about 10:30. But sometimes we would go into one of the dorms and follow up with a serious session. This particular night, we got into a deep discussion with the twins, Paul and Patrick, and afterwards, we stopped by the Waffle House. And when I walked in the house and eventually in the bedroom, Didi looked at me with one of those cold stares and started crying. "What's wrong, boo? What's wrong?" as I sat next to the bed. I thought she was having some challenges, you know, like in nursing school or something, and that she was probably just a little frustrated, you know, because school was so demanding. She looked at me and said, "It's you. It's you." "Me? What did I do?" You know, I looked all confused. "I'm out here trying to do my thing for this ministry." "That's the problem, your ministry. Did you marry the ministry or did you marry me?" "I married you," I said quick on my feet. "Well, then act like it. You spend all your time on campus or with your boys while I sit here waiting for you to come home. And what about a job? We can't live off that little money you made over the summer selling magazines. You need to get a real job, Eric." She was right. I did need to grow up, get a job, and get my priorities straight. I wasn't single anymore. I made a vow before God and in the presence of at least one or two witnesses that I was going to take care of this girl until death did us part. And not just financially, but emotionally as well. The next morning, bright and early, I put in a couple calls to my people from Huntsville to see if they knew if anybody was hiring. A couple weeks later, I had a few options on the table, and I decided to go with the Olive Garden. I chose the Olive Garden because the first busboy shift did not start until 11 a.m., and it ended no later than 4 p.m., which meant I could leave as early as 2:30 to 3 o'clock, especially if I wasn't the head busboy. If I worked the second shift, I would start work at 4 o'clock, and I could leave by 6:30 or 7 p.m., which meant I could still take morning classes and make it to the Bell Tower Ministries. I knew working was not enough. I needed to put some more time into my marriage and, more importantly, my spiritual life. However, there were some things I knew I couldn't afford to sacrifice. The Bell Tower was one of them. Tuesday chapel and the special spiritual events like Week of Prayers, those were some other things I couldn't afford to sacrifice. I needed to attend as many spiritual functions as possible. And I needed to stay active in the Bell Tower Ministries because I was beginning to see some serious growth in my program development and in my public speaking. If a man does not work, he shouldn't eat. Nothing worthwhile comes easy. Work, continuous work, and hard work is the only way to accomplish results that last. Hamilton Holt. Have you ever thrown a pebble in the pond? If you have, then you know what happens. All you see at first is boom, a little tiny splash. Nothing more, nothing less. But if you pay close attention, seconds later, that little splash starts to form a circle. It starts as a small circle at first, but boom, all of a sudden, that circle starts to expand. Soon, the small circles become larger and larger. In my rock experience, and my experience at the Olive Garden, they were parallel. What started out as not so glamorous, a busboy position, catapulted me from an average Joe to the success I enjoy today. It still amazes me when I think back on how a little hard work, a little going the extra mile, a genuine smile, a kind word, and yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, and a how may I help you, and a lot of sweat, blood, and tears opened up windows and opportunities and position ET for success. It is amazing to me how obsessed this current generation is. You hear the enthusiasm in their voice when they describe that dream car, or when they describe that 7-bedroom, 4-bath house in a gated community that they eventually want to move into. However, they get real quiet when you explain the type of work ethic that is required to live that type of lifestyle. I was fortunate. Yep, I was fortunate in that I learned at a very young age that there are no free lunches in life. There is nothing wrong with dreaming big. Look, absolutely nothing wrong with dreaming big. I encourage it. Just know, listen to me, just know though, that all roads that lead to success, they have to pass through Hard Work Boulevard at some point. So the day Olive Garden handed me a personal apron, a bucket, and my own cleaning supplies, I knew the deal. Yeah, I knew work. Work was more about the process than it was about the money. See, I had already made that mistake. I made that mistake when I was younger of thinking that it was about the money. You know, like when I worked at Wendy's or TJ Maxx and Burger King. This time I wouldn't make the same mistake. I would prove to myself and to God that I did not need to repeat that test over again, because I had already learned that lesson. The way I approached my work was the difference between me being a busboy for the rest of my life or me telling the world how being a busboy was a part of this amazing journey that began years ago. And through trial and error, 4 years after the day I was hired, I can truly say I entered as a boy. But I came out as a man. Unusual favor is bestowed on those that work. One of the first things I did to launch my speaking career was to embrace the concept of meditation into my life. I decided to dedicate the first hour of the day to speaking to and listening to the voice of God. I added listening to my meditation time because I absolutely hate those one-sided relationships. You know what I'm talking about. We all have one of those friends where they do all the talking and you don't get a word in. So one day during my meditation time, God gave me a revelation about work through the following scriptures. The first one, 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Even while we were with you, we gave you this command. Those unwilling to work will not eat. The second one, 1 Timothy 5:8. If anyone does not provide for his relatives and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And then finally, Exodus 20:8-9. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. First and foremost, God revealed to me that work was a significant aspect of his personal value system. Before he ever asked me to go to work, he went to work. And according to Genesis, even before any signs or miracles were wrought, God himself worked. And I'm not the smartest dude in the world, but I just believe it did not take God 6 days to create the heavens and the earth. I believe he could have done it in an hour. Well, probably 30 seconds if he wanted to. So he modeled. Are you hearing me? He modeled what he wanted me to do. W-O-R-K. Work. And what I love about God was he specified the time frame so I wouldn't think it was acceptable, you know, to like work for 3 days and play for 4. Then he helped me make the connection between my faith and work. I began to understand that work is an outward manifestation of an inward change. And finally, he said, if I am able to work, but I'm unwilling, I should not even eat. I'm going to say it again. If I'm able, capable, but I'm